The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by the author of two award-winning crime series set in India and the upcoming Quantum of Menace, the first in a series featuring Q from the James Bond franchise. His debut, The Unexpected Inheritance of Inspector Chopra, was selected by the Sunday Times as one of the 40 best crime novels. In 2021, Midnight at Malabar House, the first in the Malabar House novel set in 1950s Bombay, won the CWA Historical Dagger, the foremost prize for historical mystery fiction. And he was born in England, but spent a decade in India as a management consultant. He's currently the chair of the 70-year-old UK Crime Writers Association. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Vaseem Khan.
Daniel, delighted to be here.
It's an absolute joy to see you. Now, I start every episode the same way. I know you're aware of this, so you know the grilling you're about to get. And it's not a grilling. It's not a grilling. It's a question we ask everybody. We're called Inspired Minds for a reason. What does inspiration mean to you? What inspires you? And how important is it to you?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. And I think for me, there are two quotes which sort of encapsulate my take on inspiration. The first is the old saw from Thomas Edison, I think, genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, which is probably quite appropriate to the books I write, given that they're set in India and there's quite a lot of perspiration around. You know, normally a throwaway quote like that would make me want to biff Edison on the beak, but I think he's got a point. And I think what he means is, and certainly this is what I've found over the years, is that inspiration, certainly when I'm writing, it's not one of those lightning bolt eureka moments usually. It's because I've spent years researching the topic, living in those spaces that I'm writing about. And I think it's the difference between sort of bumbling around in the dark and knowing exactly where to fish for a good story. So that's the first quote. But the other one perhaps is a little closer to my heart, because having said all of that about research and not bumbling around in the dark, there's a great line by the late, great Sir Terry Pratchett, who wrote the Discworld novels. And, you know, in a very real sense, and maybe we can talk about this later, he's responsible for my whole career in writing. And he said somewhere in one of those books, inspiration is sleeting through the multiverse, just waiting for the right head to fall into. I've always loved the idea that there are these shooting stars of inspiration just waiting for the right head. And it's quite appropriate to me. My wife is always telling me I'm far too big-headed. But I like to interpret that as a notion that I have a sort of radar dish shaped head waiting for the right idea.
Well, I want to go straight into Terry Pratchett, actually, because I've seen it said, or you have said yourself, that Terry Pratchett was the inspiration for your becoming a writer in the first place, a 17-year-old. Did you not write your first novel at 17?
I did indeed, yeah.
What was it about Terry Pratchett's world that inspired you to become a writer?
Well, two things, I guess. I mean, I started reading Pratchett in the library. So we had no money when we were growing up. My parents were from the subcontinent. My dad worked in a factory his whole life, and he only had one ambition for us, which was to get properly educated and to make a better fist of a career than he'd managed. But that was partly because, you know, he had no education to fall back on. But one thing he wouldn't countenance was buying books for me. Textbooks were fine. So it wasn't until I hit the local library that I got to read wider fare. And I came across the Discworld novels. And firstly, of course, they're brilliant if someone hasn't read them. But they're also very satirical takes on reality, the reality that surrounds us. That was Terry Pratchett's great, great gift to pierce the human condition and make us laugh at the same time. But the other thing I thought about those books was that this looks really easy. And I decided that, you know, I could be a writer. So I wrote my first novel, a comic fantasy a la Pratchett. And then I sent it off to just a couple of agents because I thought, you know, I don't really need to send it any wider than that. Then I went to my parents and I said, I'm not going to university because I'm going to be a rich and famous writer. And you can imagine what Asian parents made of that particular. I mean, there was one flaw in my cunning plan, obviously, which was that the book was a little bit crap, if I'm allowed to use such a term on your august podcast. So I did end up getting my rejection letters and I spent the next 20 odd years writing, I think, six more novels across various genres until I was eventually published at age 40.
See, what I'm getting from all of that is that you had tremendous confidence as a young man. Now, a lot of young men have confidence. It's almost sort of evolutionarily determined, isn't it, that we have ideas above our station. And by station, I mean a 17-year-old has no business thinking that they're a fully fledged author. We all think we can play football for England or become prime minister or whatever it is when we're 17. So you're no different in that regard. But I'm interested in the Vasim that grew up in the East End with first-generation immigrants. And you've described there your parents as if they were classic Asian parents, insofar as they wanted a good education for you. And I think I've heard you talk about, you know, doctor, accountant, lawyer, that sort of a world. And yet you've swanned in there and said, no, I'm going to be a novelist. But you must have had quite a lot of self-possession at that point.
I think it's like anything else in life that hits upon a passion early for us. You know, it's something that we carry throughout our whole lives. Now, it just so happened for me that books and reading were a wonderful escape from, I wouldn't say a harsh upbringing. You know, I'm not going to pretend that my life was one of absolute immigrant angst, because it wasn't. I had a very good childhood. And at the age of 11, my parents sent me away from the local area in the East London where I was growing up to a very, very good grammar school further along in Essex. And that completely changed things. I was one of only two non-white people in the school. But, you know, I didn't suffer from it. On the contrary, the education I received there, the experiences that I gained there, they set me up to have a very good appreciation of not just the written word, but fiction across the piece. And I think that was the foundation stone for me wanting to write.
Words are really important to you. It's a very crass thing to say to a writer, but I've read many a writer, like, you know, for example, I'm as guilty as the next man of being exhausted and thinking, I'm by a pool on holiday, I'm going to read a Jack Reacher book because I don't want to think. I just want some right rollicking plot to take me somewhere. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with a Jack Reacher book. But let's say that he's not as interested in language, metaphor and simile as you are. And when reading your books, and I've just finished reading Death of a Lesser God, language is so important to you, and metaphor and simile are so important to you, aren't they? There are so many references to how somebody looks like a type of animal or how they're behaving in a certain way that's not incongruous, far from it, but it's just not in that scene. It's sort of your editorializing, and it brings the whole thing to life. So were you brought up with words being sort of tools of wit? Because it's very witty when you're reading it.
Well, thank you. That's nice of you to say. Well, that's one of the lessons I learned from Terry Pratchett, because he uses humor, he uses satire to poke fun at human institutions and our very many foibles. Yes, language is incredibly important to me. For years, I tried to be a literary writer. And, you know, the definition between literary and other genres is now, I think, it's smoothed out a little bit. So we don't really have so much of a conflict. Certainly, I never felt there was any conflict between more commercial genres. I mean, you mentioned Jack Reacher. Lee Child happens to be a friend of mine. And I do like the Reacher books. And, you know, they've sold gazillions of copies. So clearly, there's something in there that hooks people in. But I do appreciate a well-turned phrase. And I spent in my 30s, I went through this exercise where I made a list of 100 of the greatest novels ever written. Booker Prize winners, Pulitzer Prize winners, The Times has a list, The Independent has a list. And I just plucked out 100. And you normally start with Ulysses by James Joyce and you go down the list. And, you know, once I did that, I then started reading them. And I, you know, I would annotate and I would take out wonderful lines that I'd read in there. It took me 5 years to read them all. And, you know, I didn't get on with all of them, but no writing course could have taught me more about the actual craft of writing than that particular exercise. I think it's instinctive. It's second nature for me now that when I am writing a book like Death of a Lesser God, the Malabar House novels, it suits the style of those novels and the period that they're trying to talk about.
I've also seen you describe a childhood in which you were kind of immersed in very English TV, you know, Only Fools and Horses, Poirot, we'll come on to Poirot, because I know how important Agatha Christie is to you. Were those the staple cultural influences for Vasim as he grew up?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, there were five of us, five kids, five brothers and sisters. My parents were incredibly busy after getting married because we all came along one after the other. I'm the oldest. Our range of interests were quite narrow in terms of what we were watching. And there was something about, well, Only Fools and Horses, I think it's intergenerational. You know, kids can watch it with their parents and grandparents. And I think that the fact that it stood the test of time so many years later. My wife, who is Indian from Bombay, When she came over to live with me here in the UK, she fell in love with Only Fools and Horses. And we were just rewatching an episode the other day, which is, you know, bonkers to me that someone who grew up in Bombay would find the antics of David Jason and Nicholas Lyndhurst so wonderfully funny. But Poirot was, I think, a case in point where something that happens much earlier in your life can inspire you a lot later on. And the reason that I fell in love with Poirot was not just because of the plots, it's because my dad and I would watch that particular series together. And at first I thought it was because, you know, my dad had a magnificent mustache a la Poirot, but I could never work out why he was so interested because his English wasn't very good. And yet he used to follow this. And halfway through the episodes, he would usually point to someone on the screen and say, "That's the killer," in Urdu. He turned to me in Urdu and say it. And it was uncanny how right he was so much of the time. And I have no idea if he had a sixth sense for a killer. But, you know, that stayed with me so that later when I began to read Christie, it would always remind me of my dad. And even now that he's passed on, it's a shared memory that, you know, I still hold quite dear.
You talk about puzzles quite a bit, and that Poirot and Agatha Christie generally, one of the things you love about the setup of a Poirot novel is that it is a puzzle that you can unlock. And you've talked about putting that into your own writing. Well, explain to me, is it because when you were reading the Agatha Christie books, you wanted to be right? You wanted to work out who'd done it halfway before the book was over, you know?
Yeah, I think crime fiction is such a broad church now. And you mentioned the Reacher novels, which are thrillers, and you've got a very big, very large man going around punching people in the face. The end where I sort of fish is the intellectual challenge. It is the Agatha Christie golden age vision of crime fiction that's been handed down to us, where it's very much about setting cryptic clues and a range of suspects and shoe leather rather than digital forensics and the rest. And I think, looking at the readership I now have in various places and the kind of emails and messages that I get, I think I won't say that golden age crime fiction, Christie style crime fiction, has gone through a renaissance, but it's certainly, because I don't think it ever went away, but it's certainly something that is so incredibly popular at the moment that for me, it just seemed a natural thing to lean into that just because of the nature of the things that I like to read myself.
I mean, it is extraordinary, the popularity of it, not just what Agatha Christie achieved in her lifetime, but we seem never to want to give it up. I mean, I don't know how many different adaptations of Evil Under the Sun or The Mirror Cracked I've watched. Does each generation have to have like a new version? Was it Sarah Phelps has been doing some as well, where the plots get slightly twisted and contorted, not necessarily the precise plots of Agatha Christie, but it's still noticeably Agatha Christie. Why does Agatha Christie need to keep being reinterpreted, almost like Shakespeare, I suppose?
Well, I think firstly, it's because her work is so unbelievably popular across the world. I mean, I was recently doing an event at the British Library with a very famous Indian film director, and he has just adapted The Sitavid Mystery. It's got a completely different title in India, of course. But because it was India and because he was a Bollywood film director, it, of course, had lots of dancing and all of the rest of these tropes that we associate with the Indian cinema. But it did the job. And Christie herself as a writer is unbelievably popular across the subcontinent. Whether or not her message will stand another 100 years, I don't know. But like the old saying goes, the only writers more popular than Christie are God and Shakespeare. So who knows?
I mean, it's murder, though, isn't it, every time? And we get extremely excited by murder. I'm trying to think in terms of genre, you know, heist movies, the sort of Robin Hood characters that might steal from the rich and get away with it. There was a terrific Spanish series called Money Heist, and everybody gets really into it because you're sort of taking off the bad guy. That's a genre that everybody can get down with. Revenge, I think, is something everyone can get down with. But there's something particularly visceral about murder that gets us all gripped.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to Christie-style murder, it's also the notion that if you look at the villains in her novels, they're usually toffs, right? So the idea of toffs getting their comeuppance, I think, appeals to the vast majority of people who are reading this kind of work. And I do have to be honest, I think, to your listeners, that in my Malabar House series, the series set in 1950s India, I'm five books in, I'm writing the sixth, I do kill a lot of white people. which I think is fair exchange for 300 years of colonialism. But it's because I also have a lot of of white readers. I have readers in England, in America, in Australia, in New Zealand. I have readers in India as well. But the fact is, I'm trying to create something that's both familiar and unfamiliar to readers, because a lot of crime fiction readers won't have read crime fiction set in a place as exotic as India. And for them to then find, oh, wait a minute, this isn't too alien for me to enjoy, because there are tropes here that I recognize. There are Christie-ish style plots. There are white people getting their comeuppance. And I think that stood me in good stead as far as the series has gone.
One of the things that really hits you when you read it, as a man who's been around India a fair bit because of my job, I've experienced and seen the side of India, which is pretty antagonistic to English people and British, but I say British people, less antagonistic to the Irish and the Scottish, but very much so to the English. It's very easy to understand why on a surface level. I mean, you'd have to be incredibly insensitive not to think that 300 years of colonialism might have coloured people's judgment towards the people who were the colonialists. But you confront it really interestingly by, I think, reminding the reader, and I'm talking about me here because I'm the one who's being reminded, but of events that we're never taught, of things that we didn't really realise, the things that underpin that antagonism. And you can sort of come up short every now and then as you're reading it and feel a sort of pang of guilt and responsibility, which I don't normally feel, because to be brutally honest with you, none of my family ever got to be colonialists. They were shepherds and doing useless things like being sent to war. But but that attitude that you bring forth, expressed sometimes by your hero Persis, is really quite jolting. That is deliberate, I'm presuming.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, look, I grew up in this country, and I went to India age 23, as you mentioned in the intro, to work as a management consultant. And I worked for a small consultancy here after I qualified. And my boss came in one day, and he was a lovely, snowy-haired gent from Kent. His name was Terry. And he looked around the office, and he walked over to me, and he said, "Vaz, I've just got this big contract in India. You look like you can speak Indian. Would you like to come to India with me?" Yeah, I mean, he was saying it a little tongue-in-cheek. And after a few months, he'd been there, and then he turned to me and he said, "Vaz, I need to talk to you. I'm really worried." I said, "Well, Terry, what's wrong?" And he said, "Vaz, I'm really worried about these Indians." I said, "Oh, no, Terry, what have they done?" He said, "Well, why are they always so happy to see me? Don't they know what my ancestors did here?" And he was semi-joking, but I think he was taken aback by how much love and affection he was shown. And I think most people, not everyone, as you've hinted, but most people who go to India from Britain now, they go perhaps slightly little trepidatious if they're going outside of the main holiday spots, but they are then overwhelmed, bowled over by how welcoming Indians are. And that's because India is so far along from that era, so far into its own future, that they don't have time to spend too much on history. I didn't learn anything about Indian history until I went to live and work out there. And that always felt to me a gap in our knowledge and what we're taught in our schools here, because 300 years is a long time to have a relationship with another country, and never to mention it in our own history curriculum. And so part of the reason why I write these Malabar House novels is because they explore the foundations of modern India. And although India is a culture that's thousands of years old, the truth is that the India that we see today is largely a function of the British time in India and what happened immediately afterwards in 1947 and beyond, when India took the reins again and had to decide what kind of country it was going to be.
Indeed. And it is an extraordinary gap in English people's knowledge. And I don't want to characterize my time in India as being filled with antagonism, far from it. But there is a need to remind English people by a lot of, my Indian colleagues, who invented what and who actually did things first. And because English people aren't taught this, if they're taught anything, they're sort of taught that England went into India and built a load of trains, and as a result, India was left with a brilliant infrastructure. And you sort of think, well, it can't really be quite as simple as that. And you try to dig down a little bit. There's a kind of schizophrenic attitude to the English that you get when you're out there, because exactly you get that incredibly welcoming sense where you are, where you go around. And I think it sort of feels like it sometimes is done on class lines, perhaps a touch. The less wealthy people are, the more ingratiating and warm they can be to you. And perhaps sometimes when you're dealing with people of a higher status, there's a need to remind you of what went before. And we can be very naive stumbling into these situations. And it feels like some of your characters actually in the Malabar House series, the English characters, a bit taken aback and a bit shocked by the attitude.
I think you're absolutely correct there. I think the more educated Indians become, the more they learn about their own history, the more they feel the need to remind the world, not just Brits, but the world, about all of the amazing things that India has achieved and perhaps have been overlooked by history books, which were, you know, as they say, history is written by the winners, and the winners don't usually like to crow about other people's achievements, but they do like to mention their own. But the truth is that, you know, I say this often in talks, that not every Brit who went to India was a sinner, and not every Indian was a saint. And that's, I say that because many Brits who went out during the Raj didn't go to plunder and loot. They went because they were told, young man, go east. There's a career. It'll be the making of you. When you think about partition, for instance, 1 million Indians died in riots, in religious riots. Well, they weren't killed by the British. Now, the British, you can argue, were slightly culpable by their rather quick and hasty withdrawal from India. But it was Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs who murdered each other, often neighbors. So, you know, because I've lived in both countries and I have that sort of heritage from there, but growing up here, I try and make it fairer when I use that material in these books, because I want people to understand the environment from both sides. And the two characters in my Malabar House novels, you mentioned Persis, who's India's first female police detective. She's gone through the independence movement. And now in 1950, she's having to fight another battle, which is to be the first and only woman in the entire Indian police force. But she's paired with an English forensic scientist, a criminalist named Archie Blackfinch, who was not part of the Raj, but the Raj hangs very heavily around his shoulders. So I use them as a device to be able to have this dialogue. And a dialogue I think that we're still having to a certain extent. You know, we're still pulling down statues and trying to get rid of history. I personally don't agree with that, although I can understand people's sentiments and the offense that statues of slave traders, etc., can cause. I think it's far better for us to acknowledge these things and put some context around them so that we can learn from those past mistakes.
Now, tell me, you mentioned that you spent 10 years in India. Am I right in saying that you managed a sort of eco-hotel? Is that correct?
I and my boss, we were a part of a team that were consulting to India's first 5-star environmentally friendly hotels, eco-hotels, as they were called. And what makes them environmentally friendly? Well, you have to have an American agency come out and score them on 140 different criteria, including the kind of concrete that you use, the recycling systems, you know, buttons in the rooms that allow guests to turn down the heating and all that, or the air conditioner, etc., etc. And the hotels became incredibly successful because nobody else had thought about it back then. This was like 25 years ago. Nobody cared about environmentally friendly things in India then. But what happened was that the first one that we built, which is called the Orchid Eco Hotel in Bombay, or Mumbai as it's now known, it became one of the go-to hotels for environmentally conscious foreigners to stay. So, you know, we had the Rolling Stones stay there. Professor Stephen Hawking stayed there. Various cricket teams at some point. If they weren't staying at the Taj, they were staying at the Orchid. So, yeah, I feel quite pleased that I had a very small hand in the building of that place.
I guess what's interesting to me is that there's an awful lot of detail that's got to go into making an eco-hotel. And at the same time, we think of writers as people who are dreamers, thinkers, living in their own invented, concocted world. So as you were going through this 10-year period, and you'd been, you know, you'd written your first novel when you were 17 that had been rejected. So that's still in you at that time. What was it like doing that kind of a job? When, I mean, was your brain fizzing with plots and novels while you were doing that? Or did these things bubble back up to the surface as a result of spending 10 years in India?
Well, the life of a writer is an interesting one, right? If you're really passionate about it and it's been your childhood dream. So what would happen is that, yes, I had the day job and I loved the day job. You know, I never felt that it was a job at all. You know, 10 years, never a single day did I felt that I actually went to work. I mean, look, I was 23. I was given a driver, an apartment, a cook, a cleaner. What 23-year-old, especially one who's grown up in relative poverty, can possibly aspire to that at the age of 23. I was on a European salary when it was 100 rupees to the pound. It was ridiculous. But, you know, I still had that passion to one day be published as a writer. So I would finish a book. I would write to get a new idea. I'd, you know, on weekends, I'd write this book. And every 3 years, I'd finish one. In those days, you couldn't email it into agents. You had to print out 3 or 4 chapters, synopsis, and then I had to post. And I used to blanket bomb agents around the UK, so 20 or 30 agents. Post, I mean, it cost me a fortune sending these things from India. And then they'd go into the void, and then you'd wait for some sort of response. And, you know, usually I wouldn't get any response back. Often it was just a standard letter. Occasionally it was quite a hurtful kick to the nuts. You know, somebody saying, well, you know, you're awful. Don't write another book. This is horrible. And then there was the odd, by I think about the fourth book, I started to get some odd rays of sunshine where someone said, we really like your writing, but this doesn't suit our list, but do send us the next thing you write. And I think that's what kept me going.
Intriguing. So did you feel, when you were writing those books, were you writing those about your British Asian experience or Indian experience? And did you feel that you were expected to write about that as opposed to writing about it? Because you're a British man brought up in the East End of London. You say you're one of only 2 South Asian boys in a school, so predominantly white British people. You would have been, presumably your influences, your cultural influences weren't Indian 1950s history, were they? So did you feel that you had to do that in order, because you're called Vaseem Khan?
Not at all. Quite the opposite, in fact, because you've almost hit the nail on the head there. The first 6 books that I wrote had no Asian, South Asian protagonists whatsoever. They were all white. They were literary novels. They were thrillers. There was a historical piece. And it's because all of the books that I'd read, including Pratchett, they didn't have any protagonists. And nowhere in the publishing industry could I see, other than in very angsty literary fiction, you know, very Raj era fiction or immigrant angst, which it wasn't the stuff that I was really trying to write. Nowhere else could I see in commercial genres like crime protagonists such as myself. And so I didn't think there was any point me trying to waste time writing those kind of, nobody would publish them. And it was only when I'd lived in India for 10 years and I got back to the UK and I started reminiscing of my years there that I decided I wanted to put all of those amazing experiences of this modern India that I'd seen, this incredible country, which you've seen, of course, traveling around it for so many years, transform from being a sort of almost post-industrial medieval economy to the near global superpower that we think of India as today, but still rife with legacy problems like caste prejudice and slums and all the rest of it. I wanted to put all of that in the book. And, you know, you mentioned it in the intro, that became the unexpected inheritance of Inspector Chopra, about this middle-aged policeman who retires. He's a sort of grim chap and he wants to carry on pursuing the flame of justice and he has to solve a murder. But then he inherits this baby elephant. And, you know, I should be clear, the elephant doesn't fly, it doesn't sing. It's a metaphor. It's a symbol for India. And I use Chopra as the straight man and the elephant allows me to, again, use a note of dry humor. But I never expected that book to go anywhere. You know, I finished it and then I left it for a couple of years. And it was my wife, who, as I said, is Indian, said, why aren't you sending it in? And I said, well, you know, I've been trying for 23 years. No one's going to publish me. You know, what's the point? I wrote it for myself. She said, no, send it in. And so I did send it in and I got an agent. And off the back of that, I got a big publisher. And the rest is, well, history, I suppose, over the last 10 years. It was the book that finally got me published.
And how did that make you feel? I ask because you and I have both come to what we're doing relatively later in life. I mean, it wasn't until I was about 40 that I first put a microphone anywhere near my mouth. And now I can't imagine doing anything different. For you to have tried and it hasn't worked for all sorts of reasons. There are so many people writing things that don't get the break. And then you get the break. Can you sort of describe the excitement of that? Or were you instantly grounded?
Well, I was working. So when I came back from India, my mother had cancer. So I didn't want to carry on doing management consultancy because it's really, it's all consuming. You know, I loved it, but it does take up a lot of hours. And some of your listeners who are in that space will know what I'm talking about. So I joined a university. I joined UCL, where I could use similar skills, raising money for our brilliant academics and managing projects. And it was a crime and security department, which is very useful as a crime writer. And I was in the office when I got the call from this agent to say, I want to sign you on because I think this book can be published. And, you know, you'd think that I'd be jumping up and down, but there was none of that. It was very much, oh, really? I guess after 23 years of being punched in the face by the industry, I still didn't take it in that this might be the road to actually having a childhood dream fulfilled. But of course, now I look back over 10 years and the way that my career has gone reasonably well for me, And I think to myself, you know, it's that old cliche about still having to pinch yourself that you can live out your childhood dreams, because how many of us get to do that?
But there's also pressure that comes with it, isn't there? I mean, in my line of work, it's a lot less pressurized because there's a game of cricket. I just turn up and talk about it. Whereas you've got a publisher going, come on, Vaz, what's the next idea? I sort of almost can't think of anything more scary than that.
You know, you're being very modest. I think there's a lot more to being a good commentator, and I've heard some awful ones for me to know the difference. You know, I don't think I could tackle it. I could talk about cricket all day long, but I don't think I could do it professionally, because I think it requires a bit more than that. And I think that's the difference. They say that everybody's got a book in them, but then the counter argument is that it probably should remain there in most cases. And I think largely that's because, people don't put in enough years of effort to learn their craft. You wouldn't expect a cricketer or a tennis player to just walk in and play international cricket. They've usually had a very, very long period of learning how to do this, with hopefully some natural flair as well for that particular medium. And I think it's the same with writing.
But your brain clearly fizzes with ideas, because having done one series set in relatively recent India, and then you've gone back, you've been inspired to write about just post-partition India. And now you're writing Quantum of Menace. I mean, I can't think of a much better title for a book, to be brutally honest with you. I rather love it. Based not on M, not on Bond, but on Q. So, you know, obviously something has fizzed in you. I want to try to come back to inspiration if I can, in that sense. Was that a light bulb moment when you thought, hang on a minute, what about Q? No one talks about him.
I'm going to have to all cards on the table here. So I'll take some credit for Q, but not all. So it was actually the Ian Fleming estate that approached me, because they'd read the Malabar House novels. They really liked them, and they were looking for someone who could use dry humor in a series which featured Q. What they didn't know was what the ideas would be and how Q would be drawn, because for those of your listeners who are Bond fans, Q only appears very, very briefly in the books. He doesn't have a lot to do. And in the films, of course, he became Desmond Llewellyn, and he became, towards the end of that run of Llewellyn, I won't use the word caricature, but, you know, he had walk-on parts where there'd be lots of very funny inventions and, you know, a raised eyebrow at Bond, and that was the end of it. And then Ben Whishaw, of course, reinvented him. And what I pitched to them were books where Q was a real character. You know, he's not Llewellyn, he's not Whishaw, he's somewhere in the middle. He leaves MI6, or rather he's shunted out of MI6. He has to return to his hometown, where one of his childhood friends, a quantum computer scientist, has died under mysterious circumstances. The police is ruling it as a suicide, but Q thinks there's something more to it. And then the book, Quantum of Menace, explores his attempts to unravel this. And I'm quite pleased with the title, because it was my own title and my own plot. And in the publishing industry, it's very rare that you get to keep your own title. So I'm really pleased with what's happened. I'm pleased with the book that I've written. It comes out next October, but it's available for pre-order, and pre-orders will really help. So more than happy if some of our listeners decide to Google Quantum of Menace and check it out. It's another one of these pinch you moments, right? A month ago when I was finishing the book off, I was writing a scene with Q and Bond, because one of my stipulations to the Ian Fleming estate was that I would like permission to have Bond in various cameo roles. I mean, he's not going to feature greatly, but I want to be able to do that. And I had to actually stop as I was writing this scene between Q and Bond and just take a breath for a moment, that me, a British Asian boy who grew up watching and loving Bond, watched it with my dad, another thing that he and I enjoyed together, I'm now actually writing the character of Bond, and it will be published. I mean, honestly, it's surreal.
How much responsibility do you feel when you're doing that? Because, you know, Bond is... But is it possible for a fictional character to be a national treasure? I think it is. I mean, the Doctor in Doctor Who is a national treasure. Bond is a national treasure. It sort of brings the country together in a kind of faintly ridiculous way. But I mean, I love it. Absolutely adore it. Were you thinking to yourself, oh my God, you know, I've got the character of Bond in my fingertips, not actually a pen, presumably a computer, but everything that's coming out of his voice has got to be authentically Bond. That feels to me like quite a responsibility.
Well, you know what? I'm going to surprise you and say that I feel no responsibility whatsoever, because I warned them. I said, you've come to me. I didn't come to you. So if I break Bond, I'm taking no responsibility for this whatsoever. Look, I'm
not allowed to kill him. You're not allowed to kill him, are you? You can't do that.
I can't do that. Look, I think Bond is a wonderful character. And, you know, we can think what we like about depictions of him in the past and, you know, various criticisms that have been leveled at the character. But he's evolved over time, as all good characters do. You're right. He is a British institution. And the fact that we had Daniel Craig popping in at the London Olympics, it just shows how much we still love Bond. And the fact that, you know, in the national consciousness, you know, we continually are fascinated and debate who the next Bond might be, just speaks to his longevity. So for me, it is, you're right, it is an enormous responsibility to not make a complete hash of these books. And I hope that I haven't. But we'll find out.
There's going to be more than one. We're going to get more of the world of Q, are we?
We are. So, I mean, look, to give the pitch, the estate really wanted to lean into the Thursday Murder Club series. And what I said to them is, I will give you something that sort of leans into that, but also leans into Mick Herron's wonderful Slow Horses novels. Because, you know, I think that's probably why they came to me, because my Malabar House series, it's got a similar kind of setup, a bunch of reject officers in Bombay's smallest police station. I think the Sunday Times compared it to Mick Herron's Slow Horses novels. And I said, look, I love the way Mick writes. I love the Thursday Murder Club books as well. I'll try and give you something somewhere in the middle. And I think that they're happy with that pitch. And I think a lot of readers will be happy with that pitch. Yes, diehard spy novel people might not get it, but it was never intended to be another Bond novel. We have other writers who are writing Bond continuation novels, but that's not what this Quantum of Menace is about.
Now, tell me, because as I was reading Death of a Lesser God, it fizzed alive on the page to me, and I'm seeing images all the time. Now, this might be because I'm brought up in a televisual and film and cinematographic world, I suppose. When you're writing, are you thinking at all about how it might be dramatized, how it might appear on a big or a small screen? Because, you know, there's something about thriller writing and crime writing, because we're all such suckers for the stories. They're just so commercial in that sense. Do you think in those terms when you're writing?
I visualize the scenes. I visualize the characters, and I visualize how they might look and act and talk to each other. So I do have that sort of film reel playing in my head. Whether or not these things ever get made, well, the old saw in the publishing world is that a very tiny fraction of 1% of books ever finally find their way to screen. What happens is you get paid money for options. So my books are optioned, but then the option only means that it gives the producer a right to go and find enough money to actually mount a production, which often means trying to find a director and a writer and a production company and all the rest of it. That's why so few of them ever get made. I think what's more important for me are the themes that I'm trying to explore. And you touched on them a little bit earlier, which is partly something I call historical revisionism, which is trying to bring up some of these facts from India, that Indian history that we don't really know, and I wish that we did know. So for instance, in, I think, Midnight at Malabar House, the first in the series, I talk about the fact that the forensic fingerprinting classification system that we use today was invented by two Indians in Bengal. But because their supervisor was a Brit during the Raj, Henry, it's called the Henry classification system. And then it was transported over to Scotland Yard. And in Death of a Lesser God, what I'm doing there, which is the fourth in the series, what I'm doing is inverting the old thing that happened during the Raj, which was that justice was available to white men, but it wasn't available to Indians by and large. So in Death of a Lesser God, as you've been reading, it's a white man who was born and raised in India, James Whitby, who's accused of murdering an Indian lawyer. He's due to hang 11 days before he's hanged. He claims he didn't do it. He claims he's a victim of a form of reverse racism. And so Persis and Archie are called upon to do this last minute reinvestigation to see if he's telling the truth or not. The question that I'm asking in that book is, can a white man receive justice in post-colonial India? I don't know if I've answered it correctly during that book or not. People would disagree on depending on their own reading and experiences. But I thought it was a brilliant question for me personally as a writer to tackle.
And there isn't a little part of you that's thinking when you write the character, oh, I'm imagining that person playing the part. Like, for example, when you're writing a Q book, do you see Ben Whishaw? Do you see Daniel Craig? Do you see Sean Connery? I don't know. Is it possible to dissociate when you're writing that the fact that it could be dramatized from the people that might be doing it?
Well, I'll tell you who I imagined as Bond when I was writing the scene between Q and Bond. It was the Bond that I grew up with, which was Roger Moore. So I'll forever be a Roger Moore fan. Not that I dislike any of the other Bonds, You know, I even like George Lazenby. I thought he was terrific in the one Bond that he did do. But Roger Moore will always be my favorite.
I got to wrap up shortly, but you are in the Department of Security and Crime Science at UCL. I've got a note here that says it helps manage the Dawes Center for Future Crime. So are you sort of, when you're sort of gaining inspiration, are you thinking about the sort of crimes that might take place in the future, different ways in which crime might happen? And having access to sort of crime science, I hesitate to call it an inspiration, but is it food for thought?
You're absolutely correct to call it an inspiration. And in fact, the plot of Quantum of Menace comes directly from a piece of research that one of my academic colleagues, I'm not an academic, I manage projects, but one of my academic colleagues is busy getting together a project around quantum computing and its dangers. You know, we've all heard about by now, hopefully, about artificial intelligence and the way that it can be used for nefarious purposes. But I think people are a bit late to catch up on the fact that we've got this whole new order of computing that's being developed that will be another game changer. And when you marry artificial intelligence to quantum computers, they're not viable at the moment, but in my book, I've posited that they're on the cusp of viability. But once those two come together, it boggles the mind what might be achieved, but also what might be achieved in negative spaces by criminals.
I guess because technology almost becomes a character, doesn't it, in crime? I mean, when you think back to, for example, reading the Cadfael mysteries, and you know that the technology there is non-existent, really. A lot of it is ciphers and clues and sort of old-fashioned plod work, but set in the, whenever it is, 14th, 15th century. And then I sort of recall rewatching, my wife and I have been going back watching Silent Witness episodes. And it's amazing when you go, oh my God, the smartphone's just arrived in sort of 2013, 14. Completely changes the way the crimes get solved. And almost technology, just to go back to that point, technology almost becomes a character in a way, doesn't it?
Well, technology is the bugbear and nemesis of most crime writers because, you know, if you watch things like CSI, you'd wonder how you can get an hour's episode out of that because, you know, modern tech, you just plug in a bit of DNA, done, you're finished, you know, you've caught the criminal. And, you know, we have to find ever more inventive ways of losing phones and having CCTV not working just so that the whole thing isn't wrapped up in several pages, which is one of the reasons why I love writing the Malabar House novels, because technology really isn't a factor. We have to go back to good old-fashioned shoe leather and interviewing suspects and lovely cryptic clues that hopefully inspire readers to keep reading. Yeah, I mean, the Q novels are slightly different because his background is technology. So it gives me more of a chance to use some of the things that I've learned working at UCL. Look, I'm a technophile. I'm not a technophobe. I love technology, but something like the Center for Future Crime, I know it sounds very Tom Cruise Minority Report, but what it's really looking at is the way that these technologies are introduced into our societies, and yet no heed is paid to any negative consequences or any way that criminals might use them in that way. You know, there's lots of documented evidence now that our law enforcement are light years behind organized criminals who go out, they find these young people who can really do this kind of cyber crime and other things. And, you know, they're using artificial intelligence now for committing broad scale cyber crime. And they just pay them lots of money or threaten them. They're just quicker and faster and more agile than law enforcement. And that's not to do down some of my law enforcement colleagues that we work with. It's just the reality of the resources available to most law enforcement institutions around the world. So technology is wonderful, but we do have to be aware of some of the dangers around it. And it's not just Jurassic Park dinosaurs that are going to chomp us all to bits. It's the stuff that we're not talking about that organized criminals are using.
And it always creates, doesn't it, in the modern day, in the sort of genre of modern crime, the geek who's on the side of good. You know, the geek in the windowless room who's battling, presumably, all the other younger geeks. And it's always a younger person doing that. I would love, just for once, for the geek to be a sort of cigarette-stained, grey-haired, 58-year-old geek in a windowless room. It's always got to be a windowless room.
Well, I saw a lovely joke the other day about, it was a thread, and it was about how in films of the 80s and the 90s, somebody would rock up in one of these kind of scenarios and say, I'm going to hack into the mainframe. And then they pose the question, well, what the bloody hell is the mainframe? Nobody in the computer world ever talks about the bloody mainframe because there probably isn't something that's actually the mainframe. So, no, you're right. The revenge of the nerds, they call it, don't they now, with all of these tech billionaires and the rest having taken over our lives and the world in general. I mean, a Q is the closest you'll get to it, I guess, because I'm not sure if he's nicotine stained so much, but he is sort of, he's certainly, I've pitched him at around about late 40s, early 50s. He is someone who's steeped in technology and he does use a bit of it as we go through, but he also is old fashioned. He's got old fashioned values, and the crimes that he's solving do require him to behave at times like an old fashioned detective, which is just go around, talk to people and try and get them to open up to him.
Now, lastly, you're the chair of the Crime Writers Association, and a lot has been made of the fact that you're the first person of colour to be a chair of the Crime Writers Association. Does that matter to you? Does that mean anything to you? And if so, what do you think people mean when they highlight this point?
Does it matter? I mean, it's a question I've asked myself many times, Dan. It shouldn't matter. We all know that in all endeavours of life, true equality, inclusivity is important, not for any other reason than because I think in most industries, customers get better choices provided to them if we allow more people into those industries, because you just never know who's going to be good at something and who isn't. I think it matters only in the sense to me that the Crime Writers Association is the biggest and oldest association of crime writers, probably in Europe, not quite in the world. I think the American one is slightly bigger. It matters in the sense that symbols are important. If I can be a symbol of something good, then that's great. And if it encourages other people from minority communities, and I don't just mean people of color, I mean working class writers have never really had a fair shake in the publishing industry, for example. People of disability have never really had much of a go. If it encourages those communities to throw their hat in the ring and to get some traction, then all to the good. I think what none of us want is to find ourselves promoted within any industry on such a basis, rather than what we bring to it, rather than the quality of our work. And yes, we should all be allowed to fail in the same way, but at the same time, none of us want to be pushed forward for reasons that are not to do with whatever it is that we're actually doing at hopefully a good level.
I think that's a perfect place to leave it. Vaseem Khan, thank you so much for joining us on Inspired Minds.
Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my wonderful guest, Vaseem Khan. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms, and if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.